Hello, and welcome to the TAA teleconference, Royalties, Are You Unknowingly Losing Money? Presented by Gail R. Gross, CPA, Markham & Kliegman, LLP. Gail, a certified public accountant, joined Markham & Kliegman, LLP, as a supervisor in the firm's agency services group in February 2008. She offers expertise in the area of royalty reviews, in addition to assisting the firm's clients with their ongoing accounting needs. Before joining Markham & Kliegman, Gail served as Chief Operating Officer for several years at R&M Royalty Review, LLC, one of the nation's premier firms specializing in the review and recovery of royalties for intellectual property owners. Prior to that, she developed her diverse skills set with occupations ranging from staff accounting for one of the nation's largest publishing firms of its time to network administrator for a privately held investment firm. She holds a Bachelor of Science degree in accounting from Queen's College. I will now turn the teleconference over to Gail Gross.
Thank you, Jenny, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for inviting me into your homes and offices for this informational teleconference. I've chosen to call it Royalties, Are You Unknowingly Losing Money? Because in this day and age, everybody really needs to be looking out for their own best interests in the reporting process. I hope that in this hour, I'll be able to give you an insight into the world of royalties and things to look out for. As an intro, I'd like to begin with a question that was previously submitted. Are publishers generally accurate in reporting royalties, and do they worry about reporting royalties accurately? My experience over the years has been that publishers, for the most part, are not intentionally trying to misreport information on royalty statements. More often than not, it's errors that occur from human error or computer error. Human errors occur primarily in areas where you're negotiating better terms than what used to be a boilerplate contract. Those terms may not be communicated to the royalty department for an update of their system, or clauses can be negotiated that may be impossible to track in the system. For example, a number of years ago, an author had a favored nations clause in their contract, which basically talked about if anyone else published or wrote a book on the topic that he wrote this book, the author would get the royalty rate, the high royalty rate, that the other contracts had covered. This clause is basically impossible to track within systems because it really is somebody needs to be aware of it and it needs to be followed. We looked at a number of contracts. We didn't care who the authors were. We looked at the contracts for the same type of book, and our author was getting a 15% royalty, and somebody else wrote a similar type book and was getting a 22.5% royalty. So we were able to recover the difference, and it was over a six-year period. So it was a substantial recovery. These are the types of things that when you're negotiating, you have to be cognizant of the fact that whether or not it's going to be a trackable and somebody needs to be aware of it. With that as an introduction, I'd like to touch on a few areas that you should be tuned into while negotiating a contract as well as after the book has been published. As I go along, if anyone has anything to add or comments, please feel free to chime right in. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the audit clause. I also had gotten a question regarding if you don't have an audit clause, can you audit? And our understanding over the years has been that it does not prevent you from auditing. Depending on who the publisher is, you may incur legal fees to get that right to audit, because somebody may force you to go to court to get the the order request. For the most part, we have not really had that problem. I've had a number of publishers with authors who did not have audit clauses, and in the best interest of the relationship, they pretty much had let us come in. Contained in the audit clause, there may be a look-back clause. That pretty much states that if you don't object to a royalty statement within a certain number, a certain time frame, you then lose the right to go back. And a lot of the publishers are getting very, very aggressive with this in stating that if you don't object within 2 or 3 years, you'll lose the right to go back. I think this is really because they don't want to have to maintain records. They're changing systems very often, and they really can't afford to have to be locked into maintaining these records. If the clause doesn't have a look back in it, generally, the furthest back you can go is the statute of limitations of the state of jurisdiction of the contract. Most of the contracts that I've seen over the years have been New York contracts, which are generally a 6-year limitation. And that, you know, puts a little bit of a burden on the publisher to maintain the records for that long, but we do get the information. In addition, what we would suggest in the audit clause is to cover you for audit fees. There's usually a sentence that will talk about if there is an error greater than X percent, the publisher would pay the fee. And that has been, the wording has been a little obscure, confusing, ambiguous over the years. The suggestion is that the error factor should be 5% and that it should be for the period under review, so that if you're looking at 4 years, you shouldn't have to worry about hitting that 5% because the book has had a life of 20 years and there's all this additional income. You want to be able to limit it to the period under review. Any comments, questions? Somebody? Okay, so that's the first thing. The other thing in the contract is talking about cross-collateralization. A lot of contracts have wording in it that talks about if that the publisher can recover returns or negative sales from, it says, this or any other work, which would be if you had two contracts and one was in a positive position and one was in a negative position, they could collect the negative dollars from the positive sale. So you want to be careful of that language, that it's you're really just dealing with this work, each individual work that stands on its own. Okay. Another topic that we go on to is the sub-rights area. And this talks about foreign licenses and translations. Now, what's interesting about this at this point is that a lot of publishers are doing foreign works with their own foreign affiliates. And it has come into question because technically we never see an actual agreement between the affiliates. So this causes a question as to, is it a license or is it a deal between affiliates, and what rates really should be paid to the authors? Somebody submitted a comment to me that talked about the publisher quartering it, and I'm reading this word for word. I have a publisher who is quartering my textbook by selling it through a foreign outlet, their own Hong Kong or England or Africa subsidiary, and giving me 50% of the royalty on a book that is reduced in cost for foreign sales. And this is a situation that we're coming across quite often. And we haven't, it gets fought out, it gets negotiated. We haven't had a ruling, basically, on how this really should work. And I would like to ask, I know Michael Lenny, you're here, and I would like to see if you have some other information that I don't have on how this is being handled.
Hi, Gail. I don't know if I have other information, but I consider a transaction between a publisher and an affiliate to be a non-transaction insofar as the author is concerned. And if the publisher treats it as a point of sale, the author loses in two respects. One, they can set the amount of money that the parent is going to receive back at an artificially low amount. And two, many of the contracts provide that the royalty rate will be reduced, sometimes even cut in half for foreign sales. So we have what we call a quartering effect, where they might set the sale price of the book to their subsidiary of half the price that it'll actually sell for, and the royalty might be half, so half a half is a quarter. There's a lot of abuse in that area, and if you see that in your royalty statements, you should get some advice on it.
Is there, Michael, is there a way to negotiate that out of the contract in more recent, you know, now that we're very aware of it?
There's basically, it's a question of who is the publisher, and in the opening paragraph of the contract, you can define the publisher as the primary company and all of its affiliates.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And I know that that's a situation that a lot of people are running into, and I hope that that's somewhat informative for everybody. If the issue, of course, is once you've signed the contract, we can't fix it. We can come up with the issues. We can come up with a potential claim, but it's really that it may become a legal matter as far as how the company does business and what the terminology was intended to mean within the contract. The other area I wanted to cover is channels of distribution. And you've seen on your royalty statements that there's domestic and then there's Canadian and high discount and foreign export. Interesting, in the textbook world, there is no cover price. So it's difficult to look at a high discount column and say, well, how does this fall into high discount, excuse me, when there's no cover price? There's no price, so how do you know if it's, if it falls into that category? So that's something to look at. The foreign and export, well, you've been seeing a lot of that happening. Probably a lot of sales are happening as foreign and export sales than conceivably domestic. And what's happening is the books are being shipped overseas and, unfortunately, coming back into the U.S. market because it'll sell on a foreign Amazon or another website. And it is cheaper for some students to purchase the book at the foreign price. And even with shipping costs, it's cheaper to buy that way than to buy it in the U.S. It used to be years ago when books were actually shipped in, that there were some controls at the port that said if it was a foreign book that it wasn't allowed to, you know, come into the market and dilute the market. And obviously that's a control that's no longer in existence. So you may be seeing your lower sales in your regular domestic area because they're falling through the foreign area. The other area, of course, is what's happening in the electronic editions. And unfortunately, I haven't seen a lot of that work yet, or fortunately. A question was raised as far as the royalty rates for ebooks on textbooks versus what's happening in the trade area. And the trade book area has even changed their method of calculating royalties. When ebooks first started, they were offering, the trade book publishers were offering like 25% of cover price for their ebooks. That has since, in the past couple of months, changed to a lower royalty rate, and it's on publishers' net receipts, which is more in line with how the textbook world operates. You're getting paid on what the publisher receives, not on, again, a cover price. So there is, I haven't seen a correlation yet between the ebook rates in text or trade, but I suspect that it's coming. I don't see a lot, or I haven't seen a lot of ebook work yet in the textbook world, so I can't really comment on what's really happening. So if anybody out there has any experience with this, I would certainly like to hear it at this point.
This is Richard Hall.
Hi. Yes, this is Amy. I'm an author. Yes, I've experienced some ebook royalty sales, and what they actually do is even worse than that. They break the book up by chapters and then sell the chapters individually. So I have like $3, $4, and the royalty rate based on that.
Well, how do you know how they're determining the royalty on that?
I'm not really sure. I haven't looked at it. It's been such a minuscule amount, I haven't even bothered.
And that's the issue, is because it's so little at this point, it hasn't become a major issue. I suspect that as more and more publishers are doing this, and what they're doing is breaking up these books and creating what they're calling custom publishing.
Well, I'm looking at a royalty statement right now. For like chapter 11, I got 60 cents. I mean, that is, so I think that this is something that the association really needs to look into, because it's the death of textbook publishing.
I understand the problem. Richard, you were going to comment?
Yes. A couple of things. First of all, this is a hot issue. One of our primary authors has been dealing with a publisher on his book on this particular issue, and he argues that the amount of work that goes into the electronic edition of a book or an electronic book and the amount of work that goes into a print book from the author's point of view is roughly equal. So when the publisher sells the book for the electronic book for a reduced price, and the royalty rate remains the same as with the print book, the author ends up earning less for the same amount of work for the same number of copies sold. So he argues that the electronic book ought to have a higher royalty rate, points out that the publisher is saving on everything from paper to warehousing to likely to mailing costs, ink, binding all of this, and that it's perfectly fine for the publisher to sell at a lower rate to reflect the lower cost, but it's not fair to the author to expect them to absorb the reduced cost for the electronic book in terms of reduced royalties. So that's one observation. The other is that another one of our authors has actually worked out a matrix whereby he's plotting different royalty rates for electronics and for paper volumes and different sales rates can work both to the advantage of the publisher and the author in terms of increasing sales. I certainly agree that there is a need for TAA to grapple with this and to see if we can come up with some models that will fairly represent the interests of both parties.
Thank you. Again, this is a relatively new, you know, area, and I'm sure that everybody is trying to figure out the best way. And TAA being behind this is you know a very important advocate for this. It'll be interesting to see as the time goes by, because I don't think that it's still as huge an area yet. As more kids are coming into the market with their computers, obviously they're starting at you know young ages, and this is what they're used to. It's certainly going to be a more prominent format than a written textbook. One of the things that you mentioned as far as the cost of ebooks versus a paper book. That's an argument that I've heard a lot, and the other side of that argument by the publishers, which of course I don't necessarily agree with, is that it costs them. Yes, they're not printing and you know using paper and ink and all that, but the cost of storing the data and putting in new computer systems and you know I've never seen a comparative cost analysis to determine, you know, what's really happening there. But that their argument is that they have other costs.
Gail, this is Michael. Not to be too too brief on the subject, but that's basically bull. You know, everybody knows. I'm not saying you're giving that out as, but the publisher is. I get the same statements from them. They do have some argument for some development costs on a new project that's made digital, but you know everybody knows that the storage of the material is in digital form as compared to print is astronomically
mm-hmm.
cheaper. I was wondering if you were going to say anything about CourseSmart or if you're familiar with that.
CourseSmart, I have not heard that one before. I have seen other, you know, these where they're doing course pack type things.
Mm-hmm.
There has been some. I mean, that again becomes part of, I think their online or custom publishing, and it again it's so little that I haven't seen enough of it to make any kind of determination of what's really going on. There are issues that I was going to touch on next, which is what the publishers are doing these packaging, and they have been for a long time, which is they call them kits. Well, they'll take the textbook and they'll package it with a study guide and a teacher's guide and a you know another manual, and that causes a royalty disaster in the sense that that package has its own ISBN. When they need to do the royalty calculations, they need to explode the package into its components. And they have to allocate the price that they got for the package to the components to see who's getting what royalty rate and what piece of the package. This causes a problem for them, and certainly on the face of a royalty statement, you will never know that. You never see kits or packages reported on your statement. You're always going to see the individual components. And so you have no way of knowing which of these were sold individually versus in a kit. And so when if you do any kind of calculations to see what kind of an average price the units are selling at, you're going to get some crazy numbers because all of this is being shoved into one little bucket and you can't differentiate. And then what adds even more problems to it is that they do these kits within kits, which is they'll take a kit that they've already put together and then they decide that they want to add something to that kit. And so they add another item and they give that a new ISBN. And so now you have two levels that have to be exploded. And of course, if they can't get it right on the main kit, they certainly were never going to get it right on exploding the kit within the kit. The problem with these kits, obviously, is that there's this allocation question. And until underlying documentation is examined, you won't even know what's in that kit and how those monies have been allocated. Some of those kits contain in-house created products. And then the question becomes, does that really have a price? You know, does it or should it not be, should it have a zero value because it's an in-house product, and should the rest of the price be allocated to the other components within the kit? Again, until the underlying documentation is examined, you don't know that.
Gail, if I could just interrupt for a second. I'm getting quite a bit of background noise here and wanted to remind everyone if you could please press 4-star to mute yourselves, and then when you would like to speak, whether it's to comment or ask a question, you press 4-star again to unmute yourselves to minimize the background noise since we are recording. Thank you.
The other item that I've heard a lot about and have seen a lot is this custom publishing deal where, again, publishers are pulling chapters. A particular school wants, you know, a particular item, and they put these chapters together. Once again, on the face of the royalty statements, you're going to see something that says custom publishing or abridgment. They're calling it an abridgment. And it falls into a lower royalty rate within a lot of the old contracts. And until the pieces are discovered on underlying documents, there really isn't a way for you to know that. They don't know who they're selling it to. I mean, you don't know who they're selling it to and at what price. The other problem with abridgments is there are never any units reported on the statement. You only see dollars. So it's information that's incomplete to you and costing a significant amount of money to the authors. Have anybody had any experience with that? And again, I don't know. Excuse me. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the language you want to set up is one where the components of some kind of a custom publishing kit are prorated on the basis of the amount of material that goes in from each component, and that the royalty rate that applies is, it's your royalty rate insofar as what you're paid for that.
Okay. That's language for now. What happens to people who didn't have that language? How does one argue that?
It depends on what language they do have, but I've often told author groups that the last clause they have in this very publisher-oriented author-publisher contract is what's called the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. It's implied, so you don't see it in the contract. But basically what it says is that neither party to the contract will do anything to undermine or damage the purposes of the contract to each contracting party. So what it comes down to is a measure of fairness. So if they, in effect, are setting something up that is inherently unfair to the author, then that's a way to attack it.
Most of the royalty reviews that we've done over the years don't go to litigation. And it's appearing that this issue is becoming more of a situation where it has to be litigated. Is that what you're finding, Michael?
Well, I have litigated it. Litigation is not something that I easily recommend to authors because it's so expensive and so time-consuming. So you have to have a pretty substantial issue, or there haven't been a lot of class actions, and perhaps should be, to make the litigation of some of these issues financially feasible. And those cases could then stand as precedent such that each author who comes along doesn't have to relitigate it.
Richard, has TAA gotten involved in this one as far as trying to put together some sort of class action? Did we lose Richard? Okay. I'm going to check back with Richard on how TAA is handling this, because I don't know what the organization is doing. But it's certainly...
Sorry, it took me...
I'm sorry.
Got the four and the star in the wrong order, arguing with this mechanical voice. This issue actually came to the council's attention only last month at its mid-January meeting. So we really have not had a chance to do anything more than have some preliminary discussion of it. And I know there are a couple of our members dealing with it very intensively, one in contract negotiations and the other in developing a kind of model of the win-win situation that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll certainly report on that as those things mature, but it's good to have others talking about it in this conference.
Well, I think that's, the best way is for everybody to obviously share the information and see what the experience is. And, again, TAA being the advocate can help move it along. Individual royalty reviews are great, but if the issue is something that is considered policy of the publisher, it becomes that much more difficult to fight it, and certainly it's very expensive on a person-by-person basis. And these are issues that have become the company policy, and conceivably need to be changed. And so the only way to do it is through an organized, I don't want to say revolt, but that's what it kind of amounts to. The question as far as, you know, who needs a royalty review, the authors are always the best judge of how their book is selling and where it's selling. And certainly in the textbook world, you guys have constant feedback from teachers, from students, from foreign countries, people making inquiries. So if you're getting inquiries to discuss what's going on with your book, you've got a better feel for how the book is selling. And if your statements are not reflecting what you're hearing, it kind of puts up a red flag to say, well, maybe I should start thinking about this. Certainly, if the publisher is making computer changes, that's another area where it says, I need to be concerned about, you know, whether the information is being flowed properly. The tendency is when they make computer changes, they don't carry forward cumulative information. So if you have any kind of escalation clauses in your contract, that may not follow through in it after the system has been revamped. If a publisher is merging, you need to be sure that they're still complying with the contract that you signed. I have seen situations where the acquiring publisher has arbitrarily changed royalty calculations to fit into their own system, not what your contract, the way you signed it, says the royalty should be calculated. So all of those are types of things that need to be aware of, that kind of just raise that flag that says something's not right here and maybe I need to look, you know, have somebody look at this. Certainly if you know about foreign editions and you're not seeing that information being reported on your royalty statement, that's another red flag. The problem with the royalty statements as you receive them is you're looking at a 6-month period, sometimes even a 3-month, because I know that there are a lot of people who get quarterly statements in the textbook world. But you're only looking at a point in time, and it's difficult to be able to judge what's really going on. And everybody's become much more computer literate and much more savvy in protecting their own product. So if you're tracking these things in the big picture, you'll be able to see how the title is doing and what, you know, what's really happening in the big world rather than just in this 6-month period. Again, those are the types of things where if you're not comfortable with it, it says maybe we should look into, you know, auditing it. Again, going back to the audit clause I was talking about, you need to be cognizant of the fact that if there is a look-back clause in that audit clause, you need to be on top of this because you can lose that right for earlier periods if you're not tuned into when these things are happening or, you know, the audit period that you would be allowed to look at.
Gail, could I add one comment also? The comment I made a moment ago about too expensive and class actions was addressed directly to your question of what about litigating these things. The class action would be much more economical, but whether or not you litigate it doesn't mean that you shouldn't complain about it and have very clear discussions with your publisher, put your concerns in writing, perhaps get assistance in doing that. because you may well be able to work something out with the publisher to address that problem.
Oh, I agree absolutely. You shouldn't do nothing, and everybody has you should be voicing these issues, and certainly in writing, because that's the only way you'll have any proof that you've mentioned it before. And certainly I think that if it becomes an issue in litigation, you then have some proof that you've questioned these things before.
Right. What I love about authors is they know how to write.
Yes, absolutely.
The other thing you have to worry about is if you don't voice objection, you have an implied consent to what they're doing, and you may end up waiving your rights with regard to that.
Yeah,
question.
This is Amy.
Go ahead.
Who all in the publishing company would you send your objections to? Everybody? Because if you send it to just your editor, you don't know where it's going to go. People will say they never got it.
Well, generally, the editor isn't always the best person. I mean, my suggestion is you and even the royalty people, have no power.
Right.
So it becomes the financial people, the legal department, and the head of the publishing company. Michael, who else?
This is Chuck. Could I ask a quick question?
Sure.
I don't know anything about how a royalty audit would work. Could you kind of give us a guideline of what the cost of it might be, how many hours it might take, and what the – I know it might vary a lot, but for many of us it's really an issue of does it really seem worth it given the amount of royalties we're receiving. And
right.
To me, to have some kind of ballpark about that would be very interesting.
The way we work, I pretty much work on a contingent fee basis at the firm. What we do, and this is going back to things I learned a long time ago, is what was known as a smell test. We look at the royalty statements, and for the most recent 3 years, as well as the contracts and any pertinent information, correspondence that's happened. I build a database of that information with some analytics built into that. So that, again, that was what I was talking about, looking at the big picture. We get a better feel for what the titles are doing and what the earnings are, things if they've earned out their advances, whether there's licensing monies that are coming through. All of those things kind of show up on this little smell test database. That gives us a feel for whether we think that a full royalty review is even indicated. A lot of the questions fall out at that point, sometimes even to the point where we see that the author's been overpaid. And, of course, at that point, we don't have to take it any further. But if there's an indication that things just don't look right, then we would send you an engagement letter, and we generally work on a one-third contingent fee basis. And that's based on recovery. That also, when we file a claim, we always add interest to the claim from the time that you should have received the money until you do. And the basis for that has been that if you had sued, you would be awarded interest. Most of the publishers pay it. For the New York contracts, we've always been using a 9% because that's what's allowable in the law. Of course, with the interest rates being what they are, a lot of publishers are balking at that and lowering them, but they're still paying some interest. So that's the basic. In situations where there is litigation, we can't work on a contingent fee. And then it becomes an hourly, and that's it's been about $400 an hour. But again, as I said earlier, most of my cases don't go to litigation, so that doesn't always play. That's kind of the breakdown. And it, once we decide to go forward, there's an engagement letter that's signed. We then notify the publisher, and there's a list of documents that we request. Most of the publishers know exactly what documents we want to see because we've been in there quite often. To the point where I don't even visit publishers anymore. They just send me boxes of paper, or even they've gotten to the point of sending electronic files. So that's how the process moves along. Once we've analyzed the data, a claim is developed. The author is shown a draft of the claim. You know, nothing gets sent to the publisher without the author's, you know, being fully involved. And at that point, we'll send the claim in, and then they have an opportunity to rebut what we've said, or give us additional documentation, or agree to it. And then sometimes there's situations where they don't agree to it, and then it's a question of how does the author want to proceed. But that's the process in a short summary.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
Any other questions I can field?
Hi. Yes, actually, this is John at University of Maryland. This is a very informative conference. I really appreciate it. This is my first year also in TAA, and I found it to be an extraordinary resource for academic authors. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm making sure I didn't lose the battle with the four-star general. My first thing is a comment, and then I have a question. My comment is I'm in the process of negotiating a contract. I was given a boilerplate. The boilerplate had lots of things that didn't protect the publisher, and it didn't protect me, so that we're flushing through the boilerplate. And these comments will be very helpful to sort of look for things that I didn't think about looking at the first time. This is my first time going through this process. And it seems, you know, over the last year or so, when I've been researching various publishers and going through this whole legal process in order to get my ideas published, it seems almost disheartening that authors need to think about these sorts of things. You know, the first question that opened up this presentation, you know, do publishers really concern themselves? Are they concerned about getting this right? And it seems, you know, from things like what we read about, you know, with Pearson having this problem with Bovee and Hill and Phil, I don't know if people recall that back in January of 2008, there was a lawsuit that was found in favor of the authors, and that was sort of the beginning of my glimpse behind the curtain, and it was sort of disheartening to come across that. I just had assumed that they had both the author and themselves at best interests, and that's not necessarily the case. It's not to say that they aren't looking out for us, but my assumptions were probably a little bit idealistic or Pollyanna. My question is sort of trying to take ownership of the information that seems to be, from what I see, you know, most of the information is in a drawer that the publisher can open and close and report out to us. Is there a way that authors have direct access to the database of that sort of discloses the sales and gives you an idea of the inventory, if we're inclined to want to seek that? Or are we only at the mercy of these reports that come out through the royalty statements? And the other question related to that is, if you could give as a general, just a general comment on ideas that first-time authors going through this legal process and, you know, getting the contract, what are some important to-dos or things to think about before signing that contract that can help protect us as well as the publisher?
I'll answer the second question first. And my best suggestion when you are a first-time author not familiar with the industry and how all this works is to absolutely talk to an intellectual property attorney who is familiar with the textbook world. that is your greatest resource, because that's the person who is going to protect you and knows the language and knows the ins and outs of how this is all working. And I mean, Michael Lenny, who's been on the call, he's a TAA. You're on council, Michael?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
No. Up until about 6 months ago, I resigned at that time, but I'm
okay.
Still active with TAA.
Okay. Michael's a great person to talk to about all these contract clauses, because he knows this industry inside out. But you definitely want an attorney that's going to look at this, who knows the industry. You don't want to take it to an attorney who's a real estate attorney. That's my best suggestion on this, because unfortunately, what I hear a lot of is first-time authors who come to me and say, "Oh, I didn't know this and I didn't know that." And once you've signed that contract, you're stuck. We can't fix a bad contract. So definitely before you sign it, you want to understand everything that's in that document. And it's not just about the royalty rates. It's about what other rights you have and the first rights of refusal and you know, reverting, and who the copyright, the name is in. There's so much information in those documents that you really want to understand before you put your name on it. As far as getting the information from the publisher, everybody, unless the clause, the audit clause, is very specific, sometimes it says the author can have the information, or an accountant or CPA or the attorney, but generally, or an author's representative. You can ask for this data. The question is, what are you going to do with it? So I'm not sure that, you know, I mean, if it's somebody that has an analytical mind and you know, is willing to learn the process and the information that's coming through, certainly you have the right to look at it. It's just, how meaningful is it going to be if you've never seen it before? So that's where, you know, a person in, you know, an accounting person in specializing in publishing would be of assistance, and that's why the audit issue comes into play. You want somebody who knows the industry, who can go through all of this information, you know, systematically, knowing what they're looking for, knowing how the business operates, and be able to give you a summary of what's really happening.
Just one other comment, John. You said something to the effect that you got a boilerplate contract that didn't protect the author or the publisher. I would love to see that contract, because I have never seen a boilerplate contract that didn't protect the publisher in spades. There is not a word in there that they have not gone over in great detail. It may be related to a case or a statute. They know exactly what the contract says, and there isn't any area in which they're unprotected that I'm aware of.
I'm using words that my contract lawyer used, but he is not familiar with the textbook industry, and so it could have been there's language that's implied or inferred that he wasn't picking up on, but those were his words, not mine.
I see.
I'm certain you're correct. I don't want to monopolize, but if at some point offline, I would be interested in following up with Michael. If he has retired or resigned, then if he has someone to direct me toward, that would be wonderful. But I'll take that offline and work through Kim on that. Thank you very much. I appreciate the response.
And just so you don't misunderstand, I am retired and resigned from representing authors.
Oh,
that's
good news.
Yay.
And maybe, Kim, maybe we can work out a way to get in touch then. That would be nice.
Oh, I'm sure we can handle that. This is Richard. May I make one more observation?
Sure.
Years ago, when a number of us, and I'm one of the old guard now, I guess, but a number of us got into academe and began thinking about writing textbooks, we had bright young editors coming to our conferences who were knowledgeable about our fields, who often came out of those fields, who were enthusiastic about the subject matter, and who were very encouraging of us to think of them as colleagues and individuals whom we could trust and we could work with in confidence. My first textbook was with Wadsworth, and my editor there had those characteristics, and I really appreciated his approach. And I made a little bit in royalties from that edition of my textbook. Another press picked it up for the second edition, and I've had the experience talking with other authors about changes in the publication industry. Wadsworth having been bought up by Thompson and Thompson by Cengage, and this enormous concentration of the traditional academic publishers in larger and larger corporations has meant that the management, even at the editorial level, has devolved away from individuals who come out of an academic background into individuals who come out of a business bean counting background. And as a result, the values for the textbook publishing industry, and to some extent the academic book publishing industry, have changed over the years. I think that Michael's admonition that publishers now go over contracts and practices with a fine-toothed comb, highly honed to comb the nits out of their own hair and not at all focused on the interests of the author, is right on. And I think that even more than ever, it's incumbent upon us authors to seek out counsel, bear the cost of an evaluation of a contract as a part of doing business, because I think in the long run, that's the only way that our interests are going to be ultimately reasonably protected.
That is the case. I think that has become just what our society has led us to, which is it's totally about the bottom line. And one of the things that keeps me in royalty reviews is the fact that individual authors don't always have a voice, and somebody needs to be looking out for their best interests. The publishers, somewhere along the line, the publishers lost sight of the fact that if they don't have your product, they don't have a business. But it's up to each individual to look out. You put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into these products, and you need to be able to protect them. And if you need help protecting them, because the publisher is not going to be the one doing that, then you want to go to the people who know the business to help you protect that product.
Well, hear, hear. And we'll send your bulldog some lipstick. Thank you.
If there's anybody else who's got any questions, it's been a pleasure, and I thank you for all this interaction. And if there's anything else that I can answer, or send to all of the contacts that I know of, if there's an issue that I don't know and I can hook you up with somebody, please feel free to contact me. And I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And if we all had our four-star buttons punched, we would give you a round of applause. But speaking for everybody else, thanks.
Thank you.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.